Good afternoon. Call the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order for our first meeting of the 2013 session. Welcome. We've got a packed agenda, as I hope is normally going to be the case. I'm going to start by opening an organizational meeting. I want to give everybody a chance to introduce themselves since we're together for the first time. I will be happy to go last, but I think everybody will benefit from hearing who you are, your district, and anything else you want to say very briefly about what you hope the role of the committee is going to be, and then we'll take on the adoption of the committee rules. So, deciding which direction to look. Representative McEwen, do you want to start us off?
I would be more than happy to start us off. I'm delighted to be here, Chairman Reed. My name's Katty McEwen. I represent House District 9, which was the district boundaries changed in this last session. I go from the northern edge of the city of Yahats to the southern boundary of the city of Coos Bay, and I have 5 voters in Elmira, so I go in east a ways across the Coast Range, a beautiful part of the Oregon coast. I come to this committee very interested in what happens. I've spent 9 years as a port commissioner for the Port of Coos Bay, and I'm very interested in marine infrastructure, rail infrastructure, and I think that's probably the experience that I have that's most germane to this service. But hopefully we can focus on all of the things that involve transportation and economic development, public-private investment, and for me particularly investment in infrastructure that's going to help create a more robust economy, put people to work, and get the south coast of Oregon up and running again.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
My name is John Lively. I represent District 12, which is the city of Springfield, mostly all of the city of Springfield. And I come to this committee with a long background in economic development, working in economic development, not private nonprofits, and on issues in Lane County, and then also on transportation issues coming from a local government perspective and working with the state. So this is something that has always interested me. I have a lot of things that I would like to learn and to contribute, so I look forward to serving on this committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm a House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland, and I'm kind of a transportation geek, more on the transportation end, especially with some of the issues that we're facing in Southwest Corridor, Barber Boulevard, Tigard, Highway 99, dealing with the Southwest Corridor and the crossroads, which we've been dealing with, we've been planning for easily a good 5 or 6 years. I'm also on the Tigard Planning Commission, and so we've been dealing with a lot of the transfer, the transportation infrastructure and dealing with high-capacity transit. So that's where my interest is.
Thank you. Representative Cameron, your timing is perfect.
We're just I couldn't have been just a few minutes later, so I didn't have to do that.
We like when you showed up.
Representative Kevin Cameron, represent South Salem, Almsville, Turner, and real interested in a bridge here in Salem.
Yeah, we like bridges, I think, in this committee. Representative Gorsuch.
Yes, bridges are good.
I'm Chris Gorsuch. I'm from East Multnomah County. I have been interested in transportation probably since I was a little kid. I read just about everything you could on Portland and its development. I've done some things teaching in relation to this, too. So a lot of my geography and my PhD work in urban studies really ties in with this. And I'm very interested, as Representative Chair Reed knows, in things like Willamette River bridges, Columbia River crossing, and things of that nature. So.
Thanks. We can start at the other end and then come back. Representative Davis.
Sure. Representative John Davis from House District 26, which is Wilsonville, King City, Sherwood, and up into Hillsboro. Especially transportation is just a cornerstone for our community, being an outlying suburb of Portland and also of Salem, really. So it's something that my constituents are committed to. I also personally believe that our commitment to infrastructure development in Oregon over the next decade is going to tie very closely with our economic development and the future of the state as a whole. So I couldn't be more excited to be on this committee.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Julie Parrish from House District 37, which is West Lynn, Tualatin, Durham, some of Lake Oswego and the unincorporated parts, all of the Stafford area, which transportation certainly be a conversation there. I have no expertise in this subject matter at all. So it'll be a learning curve like this for me, and looking forward to getting to know people and certainly the issues. But transportation issues in our community really are about Highway 43 runs through my district, and it is certainly in some disrepair, needs some work, as well as in Sherwood Highway, and the congestion there is certainly an issue of concern for myself and Senator Devlin. We share this that side of the district. And, of course, Tualatin's interested in looking at the 124th interchange that would allow us to build out the Basalt Creek area at some point, for which has already been identified as industrial land, so looking at how we open up that acreage for industrial land. So those are kind of the main transportation concerns. And then just cross-suburban transportation. It is very difficult. TriMet does not serve the lower South Metro area very well, and so looking at how we do cross-suburban transportation, it shouldn't take an hour and 33 minutes to go from Westland to Tualatin on a bus, but it does. So those are kind of key conversations around transportation for my community.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Nathanson. I represent House District 13, which is primarily North Eugene and downtown, part of downtown Eugene. I'm going to touch on just a couple of things that I have some specific interest and experience with related to this committee. And if I exclude something, it's not because I don't think it's important. On the transportation side, in my local area, we have something called Bus Rapid Transit, or BRT. I think it's very important as we look at moving people in the future that we remember that not every city is as big as the Portland area and can invest in light rail, that there are other options. There's something between light rail and huge investments and bus, and it's this sort of hybrid thing called Bus Rapid Transit. So I hope you all find out a little bit more about that. We've got a couple lines already in our area that have been implemented, and ridership is really good on those lines. The other thing I wanted to mention with transportation is that I'm very interested in improving passenger and freight rail for our state's economic future and in connecting high-tech and education corridors to think about our future economic development as well. On the economic development side of things, I often take a special interest in small business and microbusiness, since that's where over time the majority of jobs come from. And I also get very interested in the role that telecommunications will play. You might think about broadband and fiber optic and that sort of thing. If we don't have access for all of our communities to good communications, then we are inhibiting their ability for the future.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Benz, State Representative District 60, which is Malheur Grant, Harney, Lake, and Baker counties. Pretty large area. It's interesting. I drove 402 miles yesterday to get here, and so I had a great opportunity to look at Oregon's transportation system and its condition, and I'm happy to report that the road's in great shape. My goals this session, this is the sixth time I think I've been on this committee with Chair Reed, and looking forward to two things, primarily keeping our roads in good shape and making sure we have the funding to do it, and secondarily, doing a better job of explaining to this part of the state the sheer size of Oregon. And the fact that it would take almost 7.5 hours to get here yesterday should illustrate that we have a big state and it's dramatically underutilized. And it's a cry and shame. And it's an embarrassment. And it's ridiculous. And so my job is going to be to point out that the poverty in my district can be resolved if we make better use of the assets within it. So I'll be focusing on that, Chair Reed, and I appreciate the opportunity to rant.
Thank you. It won't be the last time, I'm sure. Our success as a committee is obviously going to be a result of the help we get from our staff, and I want to make sure that we recognize them as well. Karen, would you like to let us know who you are, please?
My name is Karen Winkle, and I'm the committee assistant for this committee. This is my first session, so my first time at doing this, also as an assistant. I live in Salem, and I've lived here for about 25 years, and I actually live over in West Salem. So.
Thank you. So you too like bridges, I suspect.
Troy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Troy Rayburn. I am the committee administrator. It's my first session as a committee administrator. I have worked in the building in the past in numerous capacities, and I'm happy to be here today. If I can be of assistance, answer any questions, be sure and ask.
I understand that Troy might be the alternate reading clerk if Obie has trouble. He had that role at one point as well. So I'm Tobias Reed. I represent Beaverton, District 27, and I'm glad to be back on Transportation and Economic Development. I've been here before, and I look forward to continued collaboration with Representative Bentz and Representative Gorsuch in particular. Representative Bentz and I had the honor of being co-chairs in the last session, so we have a good working relationship, and I think we'll have fun together and try to make a difference. For me, what's exciting about this committee is the opportunity to really look towards the long-run future of the state. Transportation and economic development are a natural match, and as much as we have the responsibility of looking at the ground right in front of us, we've also, I think, got the responsibility and the opportunity to look way out into the future. All of us have a role in that from our various backgrounds and perspectives, so I think I view my role as one of trying to facilitate that conversation and making sure that each of you gets to contribute your perspective and your ideas as we try to have that conversation. And I think that's actually, I don't want to jump the segue too much, but that's part of what we're going to try to do after we take care of the two bits of housekeeping. We have a panel that I hope is going to give us some things to think about from a long-run perspective. So more to say about that in a minute. In front of you is the committee rules, are the committee rules. You will, I suspect, recognize them if you've had other committee meetings today. They're the same. Others may have identified some changes from the last session, and I'll just highlight those perhaps as others did. References to co-chairs have been removed. There is a little bit of a change as it relates to the minority report process. We have to make sure that discussions have been had in relation to a specific bill. And finally, as we talked about in the debate on the floor around the House rules, if someone identifies and declares a conflict of interest in committee, you'll be required to file a statement explaining what that conflict of interest is. Other than that, I suspect that they are what you would expect in the House rules. Any discussion of the rules? I don't see any. Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the committee rules for the 77th Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. Representative Bentz has moved to adopt the committee rules as presented. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection? I don't see any. The rules have been adopted. Thank you. And we'll close the organizational meeting on rules and open a work session. We have several potential committee bills, legislative concepts in front of you. It's worth noting that I hope to emulate the policy that the House Revenue Committee has had in place for some time now. I think it came from Chair Shetterly, which is that the committee, presuming acceptance of the whole committee, will introduce just about any concept that has anything to do with the areas where we work, but it does not obligate anyone or the committee to support it once it's introduced. We're merely starting the discussion. So any of these bills may come back to the committee. They may not. No one is obligated to support them in any form if they do come back to us, but we try to make sure that we're facilitating the conversation. So there's a variety here. Happy to talk about any of them. Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concepts, LCs, be introduced as committee bills. LC 2802, dated January 17th, 2013. LC 3329, dated January 22nd, 2013. LC3330, dated January 22, 2013. LC3331, dated January 22, 2013. LC3332, dated January 22, 2013. LC3339, dated January 25, 2013. LC3340, dated January 25, 2013. LC3342, dated January 25th, 2013, and LC3343, dated January 25th, 2013.
Thank you, and unfortunately I have to repeat them. Representative Benz has moved that the following LCs be introduced by as committee bills: LC2802, dated January 17th, LC3329, dated January 22nd, LC3330, dated January 22nd, LC3331, dated January 22nd, LC3332, dated January 22nd, LC3339, dated January 25th, LC3340, dated January 25th, LC3342, dated January 25th, and LC3343, dated January 25th. Is there any discussion? Representative Parrish.
So, a quick question on 3330, 3332, 3329. I mean, how are these different? They all look forward to be the same thing, 3331.
I believe they are. Representative Parrish, you will also note a very attractive relating to clause in case we end up with a need for such a thing later on in the session.
There you go. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any. Thank you. Legislative councils, concepts are introduced, and we may have a similar opportunity on Wednesday for some additional ones. Close the work session on introductory LCs and open an informational meeting. It might be a little bit presumptuous of me to think this way, but I have said for a while that being in the legislature and committees are a little bit similar to college. So I think of this maybe in our first meeting as an introductory class. So I've invited a few PhDs to come and help us. Some of you who've been here before, particularly on the Revenue Committee, will remember Dr. Potowski, former state economist, now chair of the economics department at Portland State. And you may also remember Dr. Ed Whitelaw from University of Oregon. If you gentlemen would like to come forward and get us started, I'll say something just as you're getting settled. As I mentioned, I think we have some immediate questions, but we've also got real questions about the long-run future of the state, and these gentlemen are in particularly good spots to give us some tools and some perspectives as we begin our work and thinking about the long-run future of the state. So I think they will we'll get us started, and we'll have time for some good discussion.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Yes, sir.
I'm confident Tom can handle his presentation on his own.
Okay.
So we'll wait until he...
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that just one?
I believe it is. No, I have two.
Thank you, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Apologize for the delay. Pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, Vice Chair, Representative Benz, members of the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski. I'm a professor of economics at Portland State University, also the chair of the department and director of the newly formed Northwest Economic Research Center. And we're sure you'll be able to remember NERC, because we're just one letter away from nerd. All right, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to be rather short and just talk about a few items coming up, I think, in the economy. And as the topic stated, some things to think about. I chose a rather well-known financial analyst here, Joyce Brothers. Really, this is what we're going through, a very, very long hangover. And we shouldn't be surprised that the economy is being slow to adjust. The recession in the U.S. was essentially over in the summer of 2009. If you look at the employment statistics for the state of Oregon, basically about the same period of time, the job losses bottomed out, but it's been a very, very slow climb back up. I was either trying to decide on this quote to start off with or a quote from Will Rogers. And his quote was, if stupidity got us into this mess, then why can't it get us out? And part of that is what tools we have are really the same tools in terms of helping the financial system. So long-haul following financial crisis. History has shown us various countries have gone through major financial crises. When the U.S. had one during the Great Depression, it just takes a long time for recovery. And we've got to recognize part of the problem for this is that financial markets are really the communication link between all other markets. How does one borrow? How does one lend? These bring together the markets. A person that is in retail needs a credit in order to stock the inventory. Another person needs to borrow in order to possibly buy something from this retailer. And when that confidence part breaks down in the economic system, that communication link takes a long time to get back together. And that's what we're presently seeing. But it's happening. The recovery is in place. I don't think there's much that could really push it off track, but there isn't much out there either to make it go real fast. So this is, I always show this to prove that I have a PhD in economics, so I give the chart that nobody can understand. But these are all past economic business cycles. And over there on the, up here on the right, left I should say, is peak of employment. And then we hit recessions. And as we can see, employment starts to fall, the recession bottoms out, we get a recovery. And when we get back to this same line up here, then we're back to the same level of jobs we had before the recession hit. And as you can see, our present recession in the U.S. is one where we're not back up to that line yet. We've been going 58 months. So if we're talking about the mid 2009 till now, expectations are that it won't be possibly till 2015, maybe late 2015, given the rate at which jobs are being created now, before we just get back to the same level of jobs that occurred as we were closing out the year 2007. So possibly taking 8 years. And this is not, like I said, we should not be surprised by this if we look at history and what economies have experienced following major financial crises. One aspect I want to show here, this is real GDP growth, the overall economic activity in the U.S. You can see as we moved out to the right, expansions have actually not been as robust as they've been in the past. Also, expansions have been a little bit longer. Of course, we have the big drop there for what's been called now the Great Recession for the U.S., starting in 2008 through 2009. But the aspects are here is that we shouldn't also be surprised that we're not getting very robust recoveries. A lot of factors involved here, not just the financial crisis. We have a slowing population growth. We have labor force participation rates that are slowing. Other things in the past that might have pushed us up faster really aren't quite there. And you combine that with the financial crisis, you get slow recovery. Also that's different this time is what's called the difference between actual real GDP, the overall economic activity measure, and what's called potential. What if we had all the capital was fully employed, people were fully employed, what would be the amount of output an economy could produce? And that's the potential. And you can see we've dropped down and we're not rapidly getting back to what the potential can be. And so that's another change that's really different than we've seen in past recessions where we've had this large drop, this difference between what's actually the economy is doing and what the potential is if all the resources were fully employed. Turning to Oregon. Now, I've always said this, I mean, we're real independent thinkers here in Oregon, but like it or not, we follow U.S. trends, national trends that are out there. Rule of thumb is we're about 1.1% of the U.S. economy, whether you look at population, jobs, all sorts of kind of measures. We're at about an 8.4% unemployment rate. Next week, I believe, we'll see the January rate come out. The U.S. rate inched up just a 0.1 up to 7.9% for January. But we're down quite a bit from the recession highs in Oregon. We're down 3.2 percentage points from the when the peak hit, I believe that was in December of 2011. We're the 24th fastest job growth, about the middle of the pack of the various states when we look at a year-over-year basis. Non-farm employment went up 1.1%. Usually in recovery periods, we usually see this in the 2% range at least. So it's been staying, it's been constant, growing, but relatively soft. You can see that our total employment's up 48,200 since February 2010, and the private sector is up 55,300. Now, if you take a look at that, if the total is up 48,000, the private is up 55,000, then the public sector is up, well, it's down, right? And it's down here approximately 7,000. So with that in mind, one of the things that we're seeing starting to change in the economy is we definitely know the housing sector got hit horribly, but also public sectors were latecomers to recoveries. There are many things they can use. The rainy day funds, for example, was used here in Oregon. There were the federal programs that also assisted. But eventually, with revenues not growing as fast, because also the jobs and the economy is not growing as fast, lots of demand still on state and local governments, basically the day of reckoning came and they had to cut in positions. That's starting to turn as now revenues at the state and local levels starting to stabilize and starting to go up. So they're not quite the drags they were before. The same thing with housing. Housing is not quite the drag it was before, but also not going off like gangbusters either, but slowly recovering. Personal income growth is up. Oregon exports also are up over the year, and pretty much, although we have these, are down a little bit, for agricultural products and computer electronic products, we're just about to the level of exports that we were before the recession hit at the very end of 2007. Now, some issues I just want to turn to. Rather than keep talking about the Oregon economy, things that I think are tangential to the Oregon economy, but things that I think you have to think about. One is what's happening with student loans that are out there. This diagram here shows that today, student loans are the second highest loan item that households face behind mortgages. Mortgages just are so huge overall. But in terms of all the other loans, you can see that households have been getting their balance sheets back in order, except for the student loans. Those have been rising. On top of that, the loans that are in 90 days delinquency, you can see that student loans have now just crossed over and are the largest item behind mortgages that are in delinquency. And that is not a good sign. Oops, here we go. So we know we have the 40-40-20 strategy in the state of Oregon. And what I just want you to think about for students, I mean, here is your skilled labor force. Here is a better ticket for higher income. These are the people that generally are homeowners. And this is a group that's slowly getting squeezed based on the increasing cost of higher ed and also the debt loan limit that they're facing right now. And given that and it's getting tougher to get loans also for students. And it's pretty tough for a household that has to do a co-signing, let's say a parent's co-sign for a student, and they have to co-sign 75-80% of the loan. And before, they could use the value of the house against that, and that's pretty tough to do these days. So just as an aspect, our desire is there to get to 40-40-20. You're really having the student loan situation as one of the possibly headwaters that you're going to have to get over in order to reach this goal. Some other interesting changes. This transportation committee. Vehicle miles traveled. And this is in the U.S., but this is also indicative of Oregon. You can see that top part where it's really starting to slow down a little bit. You can see where we've had past recessions. Those are the dark bars where it slowed down over those periods, but then picked back up. But this is a little bit more extended this time. And so what are some of the reasons for that happening? One, of course, is the very slow recovery. But also, we have a declining percentage of young licensed drivers in the U.S. This compares 1983 to 2008. And that smaller age group is really changing their perspective about driving. They're getting driver's license later. Some of them are not getting them at the same proportion they were before. This is this is in relationship to all licensed drivers. This next one is in relationship to the same age group. And you can see 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, you can see they're all smaller. I really worried about the 70-plus group. I don't like to see that group getting more licenses as a percentage of their group. But anyways, that the whole idea is that there's a change in perspective. And you need to think about, what does that mean for either the road systems, public transportation, all sorts of these aspects, I think, bring up issues. So some things to think about. As I said, Oregon economy, as with the U.S. economy, likely experience much slower growth for a number of years going forward. Students with college degrees help the state in many ways. Like I said, skilled labor force, homeowners. This is where your civic leaders, I think, come from, too. Is this production function breaking down, that we have people going to college and then they become citizens in the state and they become civic leaders, business leaders, and so on? And then does this changing social perspectives of driving have an impact on future modes of transportation? And with that, I just want to end the comments. Don't try this without a helmet. But this is my old group at the Office of Economic Analysis put this together. And I highly, you have such a wonderful team to draw resources on. Mark McMullen, Chris Lehner, and group that is at the Office of Economic Analysis are a wonderful group of people. And you're very fortunate to have them. And I claim that I hired them. So I did a good job for you.
We like seeing that photo again, too. Those of us on the Revenue Committee see that photo regularly.
And we are. We're coming out of the tough rapids into some calmer water.
Good. Questions? Okay. Representative Betts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Tom, for the presentation. Excellent, as always. So the hangover that you started out with talking about, there's someone that are saying that Chair Bernanke right now has created another one with what he's engaged in. So didn't really go off down that road, but why don't you share your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we had to throw, in my mind, my opinion, everything in the kitchen sink at this recession. And if we didn't do that, I think we could have gone into another Great Depression. Now, the problem with throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this is, what other problems might this create? So when we have now QE3, where we're not only buying up long-term treasury securities, we're buying mortgage-backed securities, soaking all this up, these securities, into the portfolio of the Federal Reserve and putting cash out there. And so far right now, because of the weak recovery, a lot of this cash is just being held by financial institutions. We see the same thing actually by corporations are holding lots of cash. So we've got a lot of money that's out there that if things start to pick up a little bit better, we start to see demand for loans picking up because business opportunities are there. It's very easy this money could get flooded back out into the system and be inflationary. So that's, in my mind, I'm worried about that. I don't know, given our tools that we had, whether there was another way to avoid this another possible problem coming down the road. The question now is whether the Fed will be able to soak that money in at the right time, at the right moment, without cutting off a recovery, but also without letting inflation get a toehold and that expectation starts to grow. So we're not out of the woods yet. I think we dodged a major bullet, but there could be one on the horizon.
Oh, please. Thank you. So it appears that other countries are following the lead of the United States in cheapening their currency, and so that would be Japan and others. So it's kind of a race to the who can flood the world with the most money. Do you see that happening? And if so, do you anticipate that we'll see fewer exports from Oregon as a result of the cheapening currencies in these other places?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, it's a tough call right now. We've still the U.S. still looks like the best bet that's out there. And our exchange rate has dropped over time relative to other currencies, relative to what it was just before the recession hit. And that's really did spur our exports. Likewise for Oregon, as I said, we're back basically to the same level of exports we had before the recession hit. So it's been beneficial for us. As we start to get a little stronger, I think, and come out of this, and with things like Japan, which, they're the last country that worries about inflation. If anything, they're worried about deflation, and this is why they have no qualms about printing as much money and flooding it out there as they want to now. We'll probably see the U.S. dollar appreciate a little bit. But I still think the fundamentals are there, that ours is relatively lower. And as the other economies start to increase, they will also demand some of our products. They will import. Because two things are at work. It's both the underlying economy, how strong they are across the world, and what the exchange rate's doing. So I'm hoping that, we may see our currency start to appreciate a little bit, which makes our products more expensive overseas. But at the same time, hopefully then, as the world economy starts to recover, their economies get a little stronger.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I have three questions related to the early part of your presentation around slides 5, 6, and 7. First of all, when you were talking about the rate or speed of recovery and economic growth, one of the things you mentioned was labor force participation rate. And I wondered if you could expand on that for just a moment. And one of the things that I am recalling is reading an article recently about some jobs will never come back because either because of the recession or just because of progress in general, some employers have used technology, whether it's automation more generally or robotics as a specific example. Some jobs now that have been performed by humans are just not being done that way anymore. But is that related to labor force participation rate, or are you talking about other stuff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, both. One is that definitely has occurred when we had the downturn, as businesses did go back and say, if I'm going to be competitive, I've got to cut costs. And so a lot of them had efficiency aspects, investments into their businesses. And thus, as we see their business sales, whatever they're doing, start to increase, they probably don't need as many workers attach that same, in this new higher level of output than they did previously because of technology. So there's a little bit of that. The other part is just this very, very slow recovery. What does a person do that's, in their mid-50s that's been displaced by the job, and those jobs may not be coming back? I'm reminded a little bit of the forest industry. I consider the forest industry today as a high-tech industry. I mean, the type of jobs and so on, the machinery that they have, they can produce a lot more product without the same number of people. So what happens is these people become unemployed for a while, and as they're more unemployed and the duration gets longer, their skills are depreciated too.
Okay.
We've seen a ballooning of the Social Security disability enrollments. Part of people are going there. Other people, we've seen retirement 401k, you know, those accounts have been decreasing as people try to get through. So it is a problem. And part of that labor force participation rate is related to that, and it's also demographics. We just have an aging labor force. Mm-hmm. We're having the baby boomers starting to enter their retirement age, and as then a proportion of the population, we just don't have as many people starting entering that labor force. So it's a combination. The one's going to help solve itself a little bit, I think, as the economy starts to increase. Mm-hmm. Some jobs will go away, but we will create new type jobs. I think technology does that. You know, it's hard to say what exactly they'll look like, mm-hmm. but they'll be in other more concentrated fields, biotech, mm-hmm. I think still high technology and so on. They may be gone in some other areas. But it's the demographic parts that I think are dragging a little bit more probably right now.
Okay. I think I want to skip the question about population growth and get to one other very specific thing. It was on slide 7. Agricultural products were down 6.7%. That doesn't look like a slight decrease. What accounts for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, that down 7%, oh, now, so this is recent, so this will be year to year coming up. And part of it is related to a slowing in the Pacific Rim area, where a lot of our agricultural products go. And there was quite a slowing down in the summer. China actually did slow down. If 14% to 8% is a slowdown, but relative to what they were doing, that is slow. And so the 7% is not, in my mind, a huge variability. I mean, they've seen larger movements than that. But they're also coming off of a fairly good high that occurred. So this is year over year. They are starting to turn back just recently, going back up again.
Good. Thanks.
Thanks. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for the wonderful presentation. Very informative. And you were just touching on it, but I'd like you to expand on what is unique about Oregon's recession, maybe Oregon's strengths and weaknesses. We've talked about some national numbers here, but especially that piece on the Pacific Rim, you touched on it. But more broadly, what do you see as strengths and weaknesses, Oregon and the Pacific Northwest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, I think one our strengths is we've got a very good location. I think we have great relationships with our trading partners overseas, China, Canada, Japan, Korea, Malaysia are large importers of what we send out. Those are, I think, really strengths for us. The regular ones, I think we have a skilled labor force, we have relatively low energy costs, our land prices are not as high as our neighbors to the north and south, generally, of where businesses want to locate. So I think those are all advantages. I was going to say something else. How about what's bad about us?
Strengths, weaknesses.
Strengths and weaknesses.
What's unique about Oregon?
The one part that's sort of unique about us is we are a manufacturing state relative to other places, but our manufacturing tends to generally add a few more jobs than, say, the Rust Belt is adding to their manufacturing sector. So I think our combination for our mix of manufacturing with high tech, even with our natural resources, because we definitely have a comparative advantage in growing trees than any place else does. These are areas too that have progressed a little bit better in this recovery. And then our exports. China is our number one trading partner. But we also have a good diversity, I think, of products that go over to China and enter the Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. The tough with us is that when you are a little bit more of a manufacturing-based economy, you're a little more volatile. The recessions are deeper, and generally the recoveries are a little stronger. Even though I mentioned that we were 24th out of the states in terms of job growth, this is because we had a little bit of a slowing down in the summer, and we dropped a little bit. But in the recovery period, we were in the top 15 of the states coming up. And that's generally the case for us.
Thank you.
I don't, you know, that's, it's sort of a hodgepodge answer there.
So maybe I can ask you to extend that just a little bit, a slightly different twist on that question. You mentioned how much, and we talk about this all the time, how Oregon follows the rest of the country and to some extent the world. Where do we differ? Where are the opportunities for us to break out of that trend?
I think where we differ a little bit, first, I don't think we can break out of the trend. We definitely are going to follow the U.S. I mean, so often I hear that we always lag, or we're the last to come into a recession, we're the last to come out of it. And this time around, if we just look at jobs, it was December 07 for the U.S., and it was January or February for us in 08. I mean, 1-2 months later. I don't see that as a huge difference. When we look at when the jobs turn back again, pretty much right on almost the same month, maybe a month or two later. But that, in my mind, also is not a huge lag in any way. So we definitely follow the trends. What we've got going for us, and it's a very tough thing to measure, I think Ed Whitelaw probably has a very much better description than I will have, is we have certain amenities here that draw people to the state. We do draw in more college-educated people. So with that population draw, I think that's a plus. You know, unlike places that are having basically a brain drain or a youth drain from their areas. So whatever we can do to keep those amenities going is going to differentiate us, I think, from other states.
That's great. And that's perhaps a good segue to Dr. Whitelaw, too, unless there are any last questions. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. Dr. Whitelaw and Dr. Ward. Perfect. So this is like, you know, I'm going to extend that college class metaphor here a little bit, too. If there are questions, I'm not above cold calling on people.
I'm not about playing hooky.
Mr. Chair, I already asked my questions when I was in Professor Whitelaw's class at the U of O.
Very good, very good. We're ready.
Okay. So, as I was sitting here, I was reflecting on, I think, the first time I testified before this committee or its antecedent was 1974. Mm. So, and Tom is a good antecedent for us, since he always has just a great handle on the overall economy, the kinds of details he's just gone through. So, folks, I won't go through the formal protocols.
Other than stating your name for our record,
good.
And the thousands who are listening on the internet.
Okay, good. My name is Ed Whitelaw. I am professor emeritus of economics at the University of Oregon, where I've taught since even prior to Representative Nathanson's class, 1967, and I'm founder and principal in the economic consulting firm Echo Northwest. Bryce Ward, fifth generation Oregonian from Grants Pass, of all places, and he did his undergraduate at the U of O and then doctorate at Harvard, and is senior economist at Echo Northwest. He will follow me shortly. I will do just a, and I think, did...
Yes, they have.
The, does each of you have... Okay. So I'll handle part one, conceptual. And we're think of these as retro PowerPoint, since I invariably avoid PowerPoint in a classroom, and I'll do it here. I'm going to go through just some concepts that I want to introduce you to keep in mind, so you can it will help you interpret and put in context what Bryce is going to be talking about. I think it's also important to note that these points, especially the first point I'm going to make under the conceptual part one, I could not have made 1974 because the professional literature had not yet worked its way through these concepts. It's a relatively recent development, and it's not pervasive in conversations about economics at the state or local level. So let me just step through them. People are mobile in the United States. They can move anywhere. And what drives them or pulls them is a combination of income, wages, cost of living, the major component of which is housing costs, and quality of life, a component of which is what Tom just referred to on the amenities. It's not just clean streams and forested mountains. It can be culture. It can be a low probability of getting mugged on the way home. It's that whole combination of things that speak to well-being, standards of living, and the standard term in economics is standard of living. It takes all those things into consideration. The second thing I want to emphasize is if economists are talking about what Tom has just gone through, they're talking about the short run. And when economists talk about the long run, and they sort of stretch it out a little bit, they're talking about standards of living. That is, when standards of living can change. The short run ranges from, say, 4 quarters, that is a year, up to maybe 8 or 10 years. You can break that down. Economists, of course, will get into the details of what happens within that 10 years. But the distinction I want to make is between the general figures and statistics that Tom was talking about and the length of time it takes to change a standard of living. When you move into that range, it's decades or generations, not the short run. And the third point that I want to emphasize is there is virtually nothing that the state or a locality can do to change what's happening in the short run, but it can, or they can, our cities and so on, as well as the state as a whole, it can affect standard of living. But notice, if it takes decades, it takes patience and perseverance. So that said, let's go to the empirical, that is reality, and Bryce is going to step you through some stuff, and we have, I think,
just a couple of pictures.
Just a couple of pictures.
Great. All right, so Ed has laid out the fundamental framework by which regional economists think about how regions compete with each other and how do we evaluate their health.
And I have to interrupt for just a second and ask you to state your name for our...
Oh, I have to state it. Yes, I'm Bryce Ward, B-R-Y-C-E-W-A-R-D,
thanks.
And Ed already gave you my bio. So when we do that, we say, okay, we want to understand those standards of living. We want to understand incomes, cost of living, quality of life. And the single biggest indicator that you're doing a good job on the combination of those things is your population. Right? If you're attracting more people than are leaving, indicator that we say, okay, you must be offering a good deal. We don't know exactly what it is, but you're probably offering a good deal. I'm happy to report that Oregon's population tends to grow faster than the national average. That suggests that we attract more people than we lose. Right? So something in Oregon is offering a good deal. We just want to understand a little bit better. And I also must raise a little red flag. We're not attracting people at the same rate that we used to. In the 90s, we attracted people at a much higher rate than the U.S. overall. And in the 2000s, we were kind of just a little bit above here and there. Right? So there's some red flags in our economy saying, well, we're maybe not as attractive as we were when I was sitting in his classroom in the 90s. Let's break it down. So the first thing, let's talk about housing prices. As Ed mentioned, that's the big component of what varies across place in terms of cost of living. Oregon is relatively expensive relative to the U.S. It's cheap relative to Washington and California, but relative to the U.S. overall, it's expensive. And we've been growing faster than the U.S. overall. This is showing you housing price index that's indexed to 1991, so you can kind of see the cumulative change in housing prices over time. The big bubble stands out quite apparently. But even after the crash, if you compare housing prices in Oregon in 2012 relative to 1990, they're higher. They're 150% higher. And over the same period, the U.S. only grew about 80-some percent, right? So our housing is more expensive, right? Which isn't surprising given that population is growing. It's not necessary that a growing population has to increase your housing prices, but it's not unsurprising. So the second, the next point to make is let's talk about jobs and incomes. Employment has been pretty stagnant. And yes, there's been two big recessions, but if you just look at employment in December of 2012, we had 9,000 more total jobs than we had in December of 2000. We added over 400,000 people, but we had 9,000 more jobs. You know, and yes, that's part of that's recovering from the peak, but we're only 100,000 jobs below the peak, right? So that's, you know, we're still missing some jobs. We move to income, kind of same stagnation story stands out. If you look at real personal income per capita, so you adjust for inflation, in 2011, most recent year that we have data, we had $1 more in personal income per capita than we had in the year 2000. So income has stagnated. So you put that in percentage terms, right? You can see relative to the U.S., we've kind of been on this little roller coaster ride, but in 1997, the second peak there, we were at 97% of the U.S. average. Since then, we've been on kind of a pretty steady decline down, and you'll notice that there isn't a big blip back up. There wasn't a recovery. Our income has been growing more slowly than it has in the rest of the country, pretty steadily, for about 15 years. Right? If our real personal income per capita was still at 97% of the U.S. average, Oregon would have about $10 billion more in personal income. Right? So you put these together, you say, well, we're not super cheap, our incomes aren't super attractive, and yet we're still attracting people. So that leaves the third thing, right? That says, look, it's quality of life. Right, we still have this thing called quality of life, but it's eroding because our population advantage, you know, it's the advantage of our, not the quality of life, but the advantage that our quality of life is giving us is eroding. But my favorite estimate of the quality of life kind of takes these things all together and does a very sophisticated, you know, econometric model by this guy named David Albuie at the University of Michigan. And he finds that Oregon offered the fifth highest quality of life of every state and the District of Columbia. Right, so Oregon has an advantage in quality of life. And yes, it does serve to help us attract population, particularly college-educated people, and that's all great. But the rest of the economy is starting to show signs of that's, you know, maybe not going to be enough in the near future. Right, so if we're talking about standards of living and over the very long time run, you know, we need to start thinking a little bit more about the other parts, and you know, how do we complement, you know, the attractive quality of life that we offer and the people that it draws, so that we're also, you know, we want to be our incomes like we were in the 90s. We want to be climbing towards the U.S. average, and we want employment to be growing, you know, at least with population. Anything else? Any so what categories? I think that I kind of, I was supposed to hand it back to him, but I didn't.
No,
I just kind of stumbled right into it.
I was fascinated. I guess, just going back to the title we chose was Mixed Symptoms. You know, the usual line is there's good news and bad news. If we are starting to erode this comparative advantage, or and where the erosion comes in these two complements of wages and housing prices, and we've got to find some balance over time, we cannot emphasize enough that the endurance our institutions have is critical, is a necessary condition, maybe not sufficient, but it's a necessary condition for us to improve our standards of living over time. Some of you may remember the Progress Board. It came out of a group of, you might better call it a cabal, but some of you know the name Ron Ekus, Patricia McKeag, Carrie Barnett, I think there were a couple others. And we noticed during the late 80s that our legislature would have a great memory. It was just too short. By that I mean You'd come in January, you sort of look around, and there's very little looking back far enough to remember what it is that it takes to drive standards of living up over time. So as you look around the state, our institutions are typically limited to a 2-year cycle, a 4-year cycle, that kind of thing, or the tenure of a city manager. And it doesn't, the memory, our institutional memories and the tools we bring to our economy are insufficient to sustain themselves. So the bad news is, if we are short-sighted always with the problems and their solutions, we'll always miss that bigger picture in the longer run. That's it.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have lots of questions, but I'll try to limit it to just a couple.
That's
right. So I was reading the other day about the accumulation of capital and the fact that without it, you don't do that well, and that seems to be consistent with the point you're making about institutions. So I'm assuming that you're talking about educational institutions and about things of that nature, but I don't want to assume, so I'm asking. But if I can go on just a little further, if you could tell us what institutions you are speaking about and whether the accumulation of capital and education are the one and the same or different or whatever. And the second is, if we figured it out today, and we fixed it, how long before we'd see a result?
Yeah, that's a good one. And I'll go back to the first one in a second, Representative Benz. It would be a long time. I mean, that's part of our innate impatience, I think, helps explain the short-sightedness of our institutions. So let me talk about institutions for a moment, and I'll talk about capital as I do that. Institutions refer generally to all the ways we organize our activities, whether they are in the private sector or the public sector. You mentioned education. Yep, that's one set of institutions. There is our entire legal system. There is just the arrangements by which we interact and so on. So you mentioned the word capital. When economists talk about capital, they are referring to physical things or social arrangements. There's the physical capital we usually think of, roads, bridges, and so on, water systems, sewage systems, all the built stuff, these desks and counters. There's the human capital that we know so well, trained, skilled, educated individuals. There's social capital, the manner in which we interact. Facebook is sort of a private sector illustration of social capital, all the conventions, arrangements by which we interact, and finally natural capital, of which Oregon has plenty. So the manner in which we sustain each of those forms of capital and them collectively is a part of the long-run efforts we need to make. Our institutions, if you want to put them into a form of capital, would be the social capital among those four.
Paul, go ahead, please.
I don't think you said a long time if we got it fixed today. One might ask, why bother? But maybe by a long time you're speaking like the legislature, 2 years. But maybe you're not.
Well, no, I am. In fact, that's one of the problems. If we have a 2-year horizon or a 4-year horizon, 6-year horizon, and so on, we seldom, we individually and collectively, seldom focus on sustaining or increasing those forms of capital on which our standards of living depend.
I'll differ a little bit. I mean, you know,
so he's younger.
There are different margins here, right? So you know, there certainly is grounds for us to fix things right now and see immediate effects in the short run. The question is, you know, if you're looking at this big picture, if you're talking about how much is that going to change personal income per capita, you know, it's not going to be a big long-term immediate change, right? So is it better to fix it and will somebody benefit? Yes, right? So it's also to say that, you know, you should just sit there and kind of have an existential crisis of, you know, nothing that I'm going to do is going to have any effect for, you know, until my grandkids are here. No, that's not, you know, it will affect somebody. But if you're talking about these aggregate measures, right, and, you know, we have a short amount of time, so we're taking the satellite view of the economy here. If we're talking about moving aggregate measures, it takes a while. It takes a while for the pieces to fall into order and for what you do here to have an effect. Now, and ultimately, we don't ever do kind of program evaluation of your laws frequently, right? So we don't even know the marginal effect of what you do, but you put it together with everything else and it has an effect over some time horizon. But if you're talking about how do we kind of fundamentally change living standards, it's measured in generations, right? You're talking about, all right, how are your kids going to do relative to you?
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. So it looks like the mid-90s we went off the track or something. What was it that changed?
That's a really good question. It kind of plateaus in the 90s, right? So, you know, you kind of have a big run-up in the Silicon Forest. That's a big part of the early 90s, right? And if you kind of start decomposing the onion and start looking at the different industries, semiconductor, computer electronics is a big sector that's driving a big part of this. And while its productivity continues to grow, its employment impacts have kind of plateaued. So that's part of it. But the big part is that we got hit by two big recessions in a decade. Right, I didn't make the chart, but you know, I could have brought the long run employment chart, right? And if you look at Oregon's employment over the really long run, it kind of has this big kind of thing, a few little recessions in there. There's a big one, 1979, right? You see this big, huge dip. It takes us about a decade to come out of it. And then we kind of go along for a while. And then we have two things that look almost like that big one in the 80s, but they occur within 10 years of each other, right? So the problem that we're facing is in some sense global, and you know, the fact that we just got hammered by two recessions in the span of a decade. But there's part of it which is local in that, you know, obviously we have a resiliency issue, right? You know, the fact that we got hit bad hard, and we got really hit in the first one, right? The 2000 recession in Oregon, you know, everybody got hit bad in the 2009 recession, right? But Oregon got hit particularly bad in the early 2000s. So you put those two things together, and that's, you know, that explains a lot of it. But it's not satisfying. We can't just be like, oh well, you know, we just got hammered, right? You know, obviously, when you're talking about something that's been a problem for a decade, that's something that we can no longer just be like, well, that's just the macroeconomy, and you know, I wish the Federal Reserve would do a better job of managing the economy. So you know, there's something about this long-run capital and infrastructure and, you know, building our education systems and our social institutions so that, A, you know, we can be more resilient, and B, you know, when times are better, you know, we would have grown a little bit more, right? Because even when the boom that we had in the 3 or 4 years in between wasn't really that strong.
What more can you say about sort of the link between the short run and the long run and how we think about things? What advice might you have as we're looking at bills and proposals that are sort of immediate and what effects they have
right
in the long run?
So when I referred to the struggle or our frustration with back in the late 80s, what we thought we did not have then, and indeed didn't have, we being the legislature, teachers, and so on, is, so I'm working on this today or for the next week. What criterion do I use? Mm-hmm. When I look over my shoulder at, you know, the United Way thermometer, where is it right now? And if I'm working here, maybe I won't be able to see it bump up, but can I get some reassurance that what I'm doing here relates to the long run? Now, Bryce and I have personal interest in this issue.
We have grandkids. Two of our three kids came back to Oregon.
Collectively. Yes.
Bryce has his own kids.
3 month old.
If he's got kids, I got a real problem.
And Bryce was bold. He could have gone anywhere in the country. He decided to return to generate a sixth generation of Oregonians. But that's the frustration.
Right.
And for example, and various institutions, state legislatures and so on around the country, when I was involved in a guy named Duncan Weiss, who I think some of you know, he was executive director. I was the guy who interviewed him for that job in the Progress Board. So he and I, and then later Jeff Tryons and I, would go to different state legislatures around the country. They all were struggling. Well, not all of them were doing this, but those who wanted to know what it is we were doing asked us to come and talk about and raise questions just like that. And it's, we haven't got institutionalized some kind of policy center or something. I'm thinking of some institutionalized Jiminy Cricket that reminds us what we're about, even as we're working day to day, that this does relate to our standard of living, whether it's community health or our K-12 educational system, our legal system, all of those things. We don't have that kind of conversation. And it's clunky. I mean, how would you organize it?
One other thing. I mean, the long run is just a collection of short runs. If you muck up the short run, people will leave. You know, after that 1979 bust, Oregon's population growth was well below U.S. average in the 80s, right? You know, our economy was going through a transition. And we, you know, as a regional economist, I will tell you that when economies go through transitions, typically the way that the economy adjusts is people leave, right? So, you know, obviously we're still here. We didn't die. The economy didn't, you know, fall off the cliff. But the better you do to manage your short run, the more likely you're going to keep the really talented entrepreneurs and, you know, skilled people or whoever it is that you think is going to be, an essential ingredient in that long run health. Or just the better, you know, I guess from your perspective, the better that, you know, revenues will be to make sure that our roads don't fall apart, right? Because if our roads fall apart, then we're not managing the short run very well because the long run will pay for it.
Representative Gorsuch. To go back to what you were talking about two large recessions very close to each other, is it possible that that's due to our stronger connection to the global economy? And if you think that's, you know, makes some sense, what can the state do to try and insulate itself from those sorts of bigger picture issues that are out there?
Yes, in part it's related to our connection to a global economy. You know, it's in part it's just the mix of industries that we have and what actually got hit, right? You know, so in the early 90s there was a recession and it just so happened that we managed to weather it because we had industries that weren't exposed, right? So in the early 2000s it was, you know, we had some technology issues and some things related to that. And in this recession we had issues with everything, but if you really dig down into it, you know, we have a lot of industries that are tied to housing markets, right? And it's not just the 2x4s that come out of the forests, right? Oregon has a big nursery industry, right? You know, I remember digging through the numbers once, and, you know, I mean, the collapse in Oregon's nursery industry was huge. Now, that's not a huge part of the economy, but you just kind of go through the little parts of the, you know, you kind of break it down, and you start seeing, oh. So we got hit with some particular things, and so obviously you can never be fully resilient because you never know exactly what's going to come, but the standard economist response is to diversify. Right, is to understand what things are likely to get shocked together, and, you know, hope that you have something else that isn't correlated with that. Now, that's, you know, that's much easier to do with my stock portfolio than it is to do with an entire state economy. But to the extent that, you know, you're thinking about it, and, you know, a lot of times we think about it, we just say, okay, well, jobs and income, jobs and income, jobs and income. But another part of, you know, and it's a sidelight in regional economics as a measure of regional economics is resiliency, right? You can start saying, well, how does this help me be more resilient to the shocks that I know are going to come, right?
Let me let me focus on that with your question. The notion of resiliency, there was a guy named Wilbur Thompson at Wayne State University in 1968, and he was commenting on and criticizing the frequent view that there's some base to an economy, and it is strengthened, and the economy of which it's a part grows if and only if certain industries are exporting goods and services, and that new money comes in and lifts us all. And he said, but that isn't the base, because, and this is verbatim, all industries wax and wane. And so the strength of an economy is in its ability to innovate, to recover the resiliency Bryce was talking about. And so that lurks not in some manufacturing firm, but in the strength and creativity and so on of our K-12 systems, our higher ed systems, in our advertising, in our engineering firms, in our financial sector. And frequently, in the simplistic discussions of the basic model, the so-called basic model, those are seen as all sort of sitting on the shoulders of our export firms. And it's quite the contrary. Over the long run, you want strength in those, because each and every one of those industries on which we lean heavily for 5 or 10 years will get competed away, will change, whatever. So we want to be ready over time to recover. And it's that we can handle locally.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just really quick. So you can do it locally with long-term policies. But probably the biggest question, and not so much for my district sitting in the Portland area, but especially for rural sections of the state, geographically speaking, there is a recovery, non-recovery pattern in the state. So how do you get at that?
Okay, so you've opened a door a little bit to a very large room.
Okay. So it sounds like the Twilight Zone.
Right.
Coming from one of those rural parts of the state, I can tell you it's very much like the Twilight Zone.
Right. So, Representative Nathanson, decades ago in the late 70s, we were on, at that point, there were three of us in Echo Northwest, and we were on retainer with the city of Eugene. And I was fussing around with some stuff with local economic things, and I started looking at the regional system of Portland, Corvallis, Eugene. Not really Bend yet. It now plays a bigger part of that. And I was modeling after what's called the Piedmont Crescent in North Carolina. It stretches down from Charlotte down to the Research Triangle, Durham, Chapel Hill, Raleigh. And there's a section of northern Italy that has that kind of regional system. Frequently, we perceive that regional system as being at a disadvantage because of its relative distance from, say, Seattle-Tacoma or the Bay Area. I tend to think of it as something of an advantage because it is much more interactive, or it can be much more interactive. And so the strengths of the Portland area, when we talk about the two Oregons or the five Oregons, I mean, you've seen all this over time, I think that misses the point that they're all related. And I appreciate the isolation of Harney and Malheur. Those aren't fully integrated, so that's clearly a part of we need to pay attention to that in ways we can pay attention to the poverty and the isolation of some of those communities. But if we think about all of that, where OSU and U of O are huge assets, but are only gradually over time becoming integrated into that regional system. Again, it's a long-run perspective, but there are little steps here and there and some big ones that we can take to exploit the regional system that is a good part of Oregon over time. I-5 corridor and I-84 are clearly conduits for a lot of economic activity. So just right, too big a room.
Yeah. Representative Doherty.
Hey, Dr. Ward, the question I have is for you, and it deals with the chart on personal income, the dip in it. What sort of methodology, I mean, what were some of the reasons? I mean, I look at both public sector and private sector in the past 2 years taking quite a few furlough days. I know senior citizens, there's more baby boomers going out with retirement and their retirement income's going down with the recession. Is there any certain key, or is it just a trend that's national?
Yeah, so with us, I mean, the dip is us relative to the U.S. So basically, this is just showing us relative growth rates, right? So I showed you all the way back into the 70s when Oregon was at parity with the nation. The bust of the late 70s occurs, and we just kind of fall off a cliff, you know, and that's, you know, a huge unemployment rate. That's, you know, big sectoral changes in the economy, and it takes us a while. But, you know, the 90s happen, and we start to catch back up, right? And, you know, that's actually a really amazing thing, right? A lot of times, if I had shown you this chart for Ohio, right, that same dip is there in the 80s, and it's just kind of flat, right? You know, the fact that we had this kind of, we started on this path to actually catching back up, right? You know, a lot of times when you look at regional economies that go through a shock, there's a, you know, what we say is you get shocked down, and then you start growing at the pace you were growing before, but you always kind of see this permanent kind of hole, the scar, right? But we are actually starting to get rid of our scar. And, you know, that was the change, you know, it's kind of growth in Portland. It's the, you know, the growth of a high-tech sector that wasn't here. So, you know, that's what's kind of driving our catch-up. And then the weakness is, you know, it's a variety of factors, but, you know, I mean, it's in part, you know, two recessions, but it's in part, you know, this is the dirty little side. This is the dirty little side of high quality of life. Oregon doesn't have to pay high wages to get people to come here, right?
You know, they don't.
And so they don't, right? You know, if you look at our college graduates, you know, our college graduates make about 83% statewide of college graduates nationwide. Our less than college graduates do better than that. They're in the 90s, right? But, you know, but you read all the articles in, like, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and what do they talk about? Young college graduates moving to Oregon. Right? This is kind of like, you're like, what are they coming for? Well, they're coming here because Oregon's offering them something. And the challenge for Oregon
is the quality of life.
It's a quality of life. Yeah. It's, you know, you certainly can't say, well, I mean, so there's two things. It's quality of life, and if I want to be on the Pacific Coast, right, Oregon is cheaper than California or Washington, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, but that's all within this kind of, you know, if you kind of think of, well, California has better weather than we do by objective measures. Some native Oregonians tend to like our gray skies, but, you know, to the marginal person out there, they tend to like their 70-degree days. You know, so they're a little bit better, but, you know, when you talk about Northern California, Oregon, Washington, particularly, you know, the quality of life, in terms of you think of the fixed amenities of place, you know, they're not that different. So, you know, if I'm wanting to buy that bundle of amenities, Oregon offers me the cheap alternative, but that's now I'm combining quality of life and cost of living, right? If I'm comparing Oregon to Texas, our housing costs are much higher.
So I'm going to start calling Californians marginal people, and
that's okay. That's great. You know,
my only complaint in your presentation is that I haven't been able to identify an easy segue from the long run thinking that you're helping us do, mm-hmm. which is extraordinarily viable, to the short, slightly more short run thinking that Dr. Wilbanks can help us through. But we are grateful for your guidance. And I hope we're all going to draw on it as we confront a lot of concepts through this session. Thank you.
Great,
very much appreciate it.
Thank you,
Dr. Wilbank. You've been very patient. We appreciate it, and we're eagerly awaiting your wisdom.
It's a pleasure to be here. I won't call it wisdom. I was thinking segue wise as well of the challenge.
Yeah, I don't think
it is here. Yes. And I could only think of, I'm the other end of the stick. My name is Rob Whipping. I'm a professor at Willamette University, where I teach strategy and entrepreneurship classes. I'm a partner in a couple of different investment funds, and come at this definitely not with a broad perspective of macroeconomics and econometrics. Like I said, I'm the other end of the stick. I'm interested in the impact that you have, I suppose, in one-offs. And the system interests are fascinating in that they allow pluralism and evolutionary models to survive and thrive. But I don't analyze things from the macro perspective. So I figured I would just share some concepts and ideas that from the world of entrepreneurship and also early stage venture investing that might be useful and that could inform perhaps some of the more tactical things about what you might take action on. Economics is obviously extremely useful for identifying, you know, where you're short and, you know, where you're strong and some of those broader perspectives. And perhaps at the entrepreneurial level is the ability or the, at least the attempt at translating some potential ideas into courses of action. So that's sort of the general category that I would say that I'm hoping to perhaps add to the conversation. The world that I spend time in this busy slide here is definitely the world of decision making under uncertainty. I mean, and how do we make intelligent decisions now that we hope will have longer term positive outcomes in a world where goals are rarely well known and certainly not well specified, prediction is monumentally difficult, and people just don't do what you tell them. In spite of how good your product is, sometimes they just don't want to buy it, whatever that product may be. And then just some highlights on me there. I sort of have a mix of practical investing and board and entrepreneurial activity with a lot of academic work on this field and on this subject. And I'd say that academically, my expertise is in expert entrepreneurship and really early stage venture investing. And so how you put capital to work behind entrepreneurs that you think will have successful outcomes, which thus the three bullet points up top. And that's my world. And one of the things I'll point out is you're wrong a lot in this world. And how you recover from that and how you build a system that can be robust to that is an important part of the game. So that. I figured I'd start with what I hope you might take away, given that I'm at the end here. I know it's always tricky after you get all this put in front of you. So here's my takeaway slide to start with. First off, the world is not predictable, and it stays that way way longer than you think it ought to, and definitely longer than you think it actually is. So you come to conclusions and beliefs about things and you think, well, now we can predict, or maybe in just a few more years we'll be able to know the answer to this question. And that's not true very often. So I figured I would highlight three potential policy questions that as a committee you could explore on a regular basis. One of them is, what exactly makes you so confident in the predictions that are the basis of this decision? It's a reasonable question to ask, and if you hammer on that stuff, you'll find that it's a difficult business prediction. The second thing here, this is not an egalitarian world. So the world that I live in is actively and proactively unfair. Not in a mean-spirited way, but simply in the fact that the winnings and the impact is highly concentrated. And even if you try to do that, it doesn't change the nature of the distribution of the outcome, right? The economic impact is highly concentrated. So I'll share some ideas on that in just a minute. And the question that I have here is, as you pursue policy, are you doing this to be fair, or are you doing this to win? Both might be perfectly legitimate things to do. I think it's just a question of asking a question and coming to an honest answer among yourselves. In part with economic development, if you're playing in a world that isn't, I would say, often unfair in good and bad ways, the attempt to be fair may be a misguided policy attempt, or it may be a great attempt to make the world more fair, but you ought to do it eyes wide open. And then the last thing, none of this is normally distributed. It only pays to be a winner, right? It's not that it's nice to be the winner, it's that the winner is the only one that gets anything.
And so it's a world where effort does not count. And the intention to try hard is, I suppose, could make you feel good, but it doesn't actually pay. So the question here, given that this is risky business, is can you persist through the failure that you will experience? This is a time frame, time horizon related question. But in this world, given that you will have failures, it's can you persist through those failures so that you can continue to try to figure out what else you might try? So policies that can't absorb failure are ones that are unlikely from a time horizon standpoint, and also just from the reality of this non-normal world, they're unlikely to be powerful. So can you persist through high failure? So if that's all you take away from my conversation, I would say, happy day. Now, I have only, I think, 3 or 4 slides here behind this that hopefully I think are relevant to those points. So I've been studying expert entrepreneurship for a long time. And by expert entrepreneurs, these are cashed out successful people that have grown really massive companies. And just asking the question of how did they do that, right? And there's a lot of randomness and luck and interesting things that comes out. But after a lot of research in, I'd say, 8 top-tier academic publications, these 5 principles are what we consider to be the basis of how entrepreneurs make decisions in this unpredictable situation, right? They're making policy decisions, right, different type of policy, but organizational policy decisions on a regular basis. Rule 1, don't bet on predictions. In fact, the little subtitle up there, to the extent we can create the future, we don't need to predict it. So entrepreneurs are oftentimes not trying to bet on the predictions of the future. They're trying to create a future that they want with people who are willing to co-create it with them, as opposed to trying to bet and position. It's a more proactive stance, I would say. And I'll come back to this co-creation thing. Your current means are more valuable than predetermined goals. And because the world is inflexible and because failure happens, you have to find ways to take advantage of the means that you have available to you with some flexibility. You might start down a road toward a goal, but that goal might prove to not be worthwhile or unreachable, and you have to adapt. Third, co-creation. So the idea that you can create the future might sound maniacal without the notion of co-creation, right? It is, in fact, a team sport. But with partners who will actually collaborate with you and create the future with you, then you all of a sudden have the ability to absorb risk and absorb failure. Number 4, don't spend to budget. Spend as little as possible to move the ball down the field because you're probably spending it in the wrong place. And so you have to keep reserves and you have to try to figure out how to absorb failure. A lot of this has to do with the fact that failure is just par. It just happens all the time. And the third one there, take advantage of surprise. You can't just weather the storm. When you have the opportunity to be surprised, you've learned something new and you have to actually take advantage of that fact. Otherwise, you're. What's the point of being so close to the opportunity? So these principles, we've worked on this with thousands of entrepreneurs. And I'd say these are the norm for how companies get created. And the deep, detailed case histories of the people at the bottom there, Phil Knight, obviously Virgin Airways, Starbucks, and Grameen Bank. These are the principles upon which they built their organizations. They definitely did not do sort of a traditional prediction and goal-driven approach to how these things happen. The hero stories that we learn about entrepreneurship are invalid. They're much more collaborative and much more doing things that are mundane even. So we get distracted by these hero stories, and oftentimes the goal is, how do we create more heroes? And I don't think that's a very realistic way to approach the application of entrepreneurship. I was sympathetic to the point made earlier as well about the idea that the educational system that feeds these companies being vital to their sustaining because the industries will wane. Now, that is such a valid point. And it's a loop, right? You use the resources from the ones who are strong to get in front of these problems, knowing full well that it will go away. It will end. It'll ultimately fail. So you have to plan for those sorts of things, which I know from a time horizon standpoint is very difficult for this policy-making body to deal with. But I thought that was an outstanding point. So in this context, I've gone and I've studied a whole bunch of things about early-stage venture investing returns. And I have the largest data set on the financial returns to people who are making really small, really early bets. Most of these investments are before a company has revenue, to give you a sense of how early they are. So various angel groups and angel conferences around the state, this is the that nature of what they're doing. The main takeaway here, I'd say, is that first and foremost, it's massively risky. In spite of all the work they do to only bet on winners, because it only pays when you're the winner, they're still wrong more often than right. After all of that work, they're still wrong more often than right. It's an inherently difficult thing to do. The second thing that's very interesting here is you lose money much faster than you win money. So when you first get into some of these sorts of things, you make your decisions, and the only early news is that you're really bad at this, which can be very disheartening. But persistence pays. You have to persist through those failures to get exposure to the longer-term wins. So the big, huge home runs here take twice as long as the places where you lose money. And you might be getting good news along the way, right? Hey, this company's doing great, etc. But you can't deposit that in a bank, and it doesn't feel the same as when a company files for bankruptcy. It's much more concrete and painful. I'm dwelling on recent pains. But the good news is this. Overall, in this system, if you can persist through these failures, the overall return is actually legitimately promising. The winners pay off enough that this is an economically valuable activity. It is a big part of how entrepreneurship gets done, both angel investing and VC, and it actually produces a positive return. For perspective, though, most companies never, and this is even successful companies, never raise capital, be it from VCs or angel investors. Even in the public markets, right, massively successful firms, only one out of every three public firms has a venture capital in it. And only half of them have an angel or a VC. So the capital markets do play a role in terms of cash, but they're by no means a panacea. Lots of great entrepreneurship gets done without raising outside equity money. Entrepreneurs are very creative, and in fact, when the economy turned, I got asked by a lot of media people, you know, how is this affecting entrepreneurship, etc. And the only answer I come up with is entrepreneurs live in recession all of the time. They never have access to capital, and no one ever really wants to do business with them. And so it's not that dramatically different for the entrepreneurial world. Also, speaking to the point of not normal, 10% of all the exits in this data produce 90% of all the cash. So just to give you a sense of how concentrated the winnings are, that's true of VC as well. So you make 100 bets on companies, 10 of those produce essentially all of the returns. And the other 90 were, you know, shots at succeeding, but it just didn't pay off, right? That's why it only pays to win in the big scheme of things. And then to the difficulty of prediction, a fascinating thing in both this world and venture capital is that follow-on investing is systematically lower returns. So the company's been around longer, you've been in it longer, you know more, and yet for many reasons, you actually don't perform better with that additional information because the prediction is so difficult. To a more local level, I do track the Angel Oregon activity in particular, although a lot of the conferences I track now, in terms of Oregon companies being backed in the conferences that, you know, frankly, many of the people in your various districts deal with. It has a huge economic impact. So since 2003, if you look at the entire group of companies, we see if it were all one company, you'd see quite a bit of activity, $120 million in revenue, 740 employees. So it does accumulate. Even though you're doing one company at a time, if you can facilitate this system, it does actually accumulate. And although I didn't think of it before, a small side note, this data shows no geographic influence, rural versus urban. You actually can get legitimate outcomes in entrepreneurship in this regardless of geographically where you are, rural versus urban, at least empirically. A lot of people ask the question, you know, if I'm in a small town, am I at a huge disadvantage? Can we really only do this in Portland? I haven't seen evidence that supports that hypothesis. And I suppose the primary point in this slide is merely that the portfolio that's gone through Angel Oregon is actually tracking ahead of where the national study data is. which is quite promising. It's a, I don't know if you guys know much about Angel Oregon. It's a large conference, an annual event where a lot of private investors get together and evaluate a bunch of great new companies, rather really young companies. They pick a finalist set, and then the winner gets an investment from that. That portfolio, had you put the same amount of money in all of these companies persistently, would actually be on track to return you quite a nice return. But here's an interesting fact. There's no difference between who wins and the other finalists, right? So the idea that you can cherry pick just the one winner and be right is just simply not the case empirically. It's really hard to predict, right? See slide one. Prediction is really tough. And this is after spending a good 2 and 3 months really trying to tease these things out. So with that, I'll slide back to this. And I think, you know, when you think about the course of action, right, holding the other end of the stick, right, used to be in finance, and the notion of run rate is a fundamental thing. With the law of large numbers, run rates begin to become very useful. In the world of entrepreneurship, there is no run rate. You are the runner, and you would sure like to be a part of some positive rate, but there's nothing else besides that. So in that world of taking action, it's not predictable, it's definitely not egalitarian, and it's far from normally distributed. So happy to take questions.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Representative Parrish.
Fascinating. Thanks. Can you talk to me about capital gains? I mean, so you're investing in a company, you have capital that you've put into it, or in fact, you mentioned that there are businesses who don't ever use capital at all, so they're using their own capital. Mm-hmm. So you put the money in, you get a return back. How does capital gains in Oregon diminish your return in that you're limited in being able to reinvest into the next company? Can you talk about that a bit? Because it is problematic. I've heard that from other folks who are trying to help startups, and you know that every time you take that hit, that you have less capital to put back into the economy and less to get people moving. Can you talk about how that affects your day?
It's all relative in the end. I'll first start by saying I'm certainly not a tax expert. I'd like to avoid them when possible, but otherwise, that's all. The vast majority of people who are angel investors are cashed out entrepreneurs. So they do, in fact, take the returns they get from their company's success and oftentimes reinvest it. To the extent that they take a capital gains hit on, that does reduce the amount that they can reinvest. And obviously, they oftentimes know when an exit event is coming and can choose the tax regime of their choice at that event. Because it doesn't surprise them. They're negotiating for it. They're in pursuit of it. So there is some tax planning that can go on there, completely within the bounds of good behavior. But it would reduce the amount that they can then turn around and reinvest. They still do it, but it is with less capital. So I'm not sure that I addressed your question, but it's definitely an issue. And I will say the bigger issue is active tax planning among the entrepreneurs that I know. I mean, you don't move very far and save millions and millions of dollars at an event that you know is coming 18 months from now, and the reason that you know it is coming is because you're causing it. This goes back to the, why would I try to predict the future that when I can create it? So I'm not even guessing at the taxable event. I know exactly what's going to happen because I will choose to sign the documents on that day. So you can excessively plan for that event. And it does cost, there's opportunity costs for everybody involved.
Thanks.
Questions? I can't believe no one else wants to ask a question. So help us think through what are the differences that the policies that we can help implement that are going to make it easier for entrepreneurs to succeed. I was really struck by the thoughts that and your co-presenters and sort of large picture stuff. And what I'm hoping that we can take from the from your presentation, sort of the whole presentations today, is the connection between those long run things and the short run things. So as you see the accumulation of the data and the experiences you look at around the country, what lessons do you draw for us beyond those sort of philosophical kinds of questions, which we will keep in mind?
The talent and education is a big deal. Importing, if we could, if you can find a way to bring educated talent and take advantage of those in-migration statistics that Oregon does fairly well with, that would definitely be a part of feeding entrepreneurship. It is a younger person's game, broadly speaking. So freeing that up is of value. I think that the opportunity to attract people to our higher education system from outside the state would be a worthwhile thing to consider. They do tend to stay. Same with international, right? If you could find a way to systematically hold on to all the international talent that this state educates, that then stays and gets involved in these in a lot of entrepreneurial activity. Obviously, K through 12 feeding into that is also relevant. Again, it's egalitarian. Genuine talent matters, and systems that produce talent that wants to be here are good things to support. So I'd say education and retaining that advantage from attracting people to Oregon are things that would be definitely attractive for this world of entrepreneurship. The other thing is definitely regulation. And I know, and I don't know on a state level the relative headaches here. I'm not an expert in that area. But I can say that regulation slows things down and slow loses. So to the extent you can find ways to accelerate things, or at least to not slow them down with additional compliance work. Compliance work is largely separated from value-added work. Clearly, people have to be, you know, responsible citizens, etc., but compliance work is time that you can't spend on other value-creating activities.
So if no one else is asking questions, I'm going to ask another
question.
I'll come back.
This is a Transportation and Economic Development Committee, and the economic development piece, for me, something I'm very interested in, but also relative to transportation, which makes me think of infrastructure and building things. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to entrepreneurship? Are there opportunities for entrepreneurs to get involved in actually the business of building structures as opposed to some other type of business?
I can jump in a little bit and help you with that. Yes, absolutely. There are there's a whole range of public-private partnerships for public infrastructure and so on. Definitely opportunities to bring private sector dollars into public infrastructure. We're definitely going to talk about that in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange through the committee. But I imagine there are probably lots of even more entrepreneurial and early stage examples.
Sure. Well, at Willamette, we invested in one in Portland just this past year. You know, what you have in any industry is big people who aggregate demand, fed by lots of smaller suppliers that do all sorts of support work. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of entrepreneurial activity that goes on among smaller, more entrepreneurial firms in support of those large firms. So you can think of Intel, right, as a huge aggregator of demand. But around that system, there are many, many subcomponent suppliers and different things of that nature. So in the construction business, you have the same sorts of thing. You have very large CBRE, big, huge developers and commercial builders. But they're supported and fed by a lot of smaller entrepreneurial endeavors. Some of them are motivated by high growth and some aren't, which is worth thinking about in terms of where you can apply your time and resources. But clearly that industry would have potential. I also think about infrastructure as facilitating, you know, advantages in entrepreneurship. Maybe not the perfect example, but the availability of really, really inexpensive electricity is a tremendous asset to this state. It's attracted all kinds of economic development to this state, and things of that nature persistently do. So that's just one example. I'm sure you could name any other number of large-scale cost-reducing things. So facilities near airports, roads that aren't congested, these sorts of things definitely facilitate speed. You know, cheap speed. And cheap speed, those are things that win in this world.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you. One of the great things about being in the United States is that we have 49 other states to look at. And in terms of VC work and investing, we often, as Oregonians, look down to California with envy, especially Silicon Valley, and say, man, with a tax structure that can be difficult, high cost of living, you know, why they can't to succeed. Sure. Well, they have a wonderful education base. The money is there. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of moving dollars, both down from the Seattle area, up from Silicon Valley, what can we do in Oregon to have a competitive advantage over 49 other states? And you've been touching on some of those areas.
A competitive advantage over would be a long goal. I think that the one right now, I'd say that I think the Bay Area is consuming an advantage, and that is a massive availability of what I'll call entrepreneurial capital.
Mm-hmm.
Cashed out entrepreneurs are the greatest thing that can happen to an ecosystem. They fund new entrepreneurs because they love it and they understand that it works and it doesn't feel crazy to them the way that it might to people who didn't earn their money through it. So the Bay Area has been producing cash out entrepreneurs for a long time. And that gives them a huge buffer to changes in their talent machine, changes in cost of living, etc., because that capital is there. Here, you know, things that would facilitate cash at entrepreneurs would be great, but that's like saying, you know, sell more, get more money. It's a consequence rather than a cause.
Right.
So, you know, anything that can produce, or not produce, anything that can free up the ability for great companies to be born should naturally cause that to happen. Money is unbelievably fluid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think money is the constraint here. Maybe entrepreneurial capital is a little bit of a constraint, but not generally. Talent production out of the education system, policies that people want to move into, right? These things aren't so bad. At the risk of demeaning my particular industry, you know, the higher education business in our state's not particularly strong. I'll put Willamette in front of that, but in addition to Willamette, I'd say all of our universities are solid but not outstanding,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that we're recruiting a lot of the greatest talent from around the country to come to our higher education, and if we did, that would be an advantage to us. There's opportunity costs in those sorts of things, but I guess what I would respond to most directly is I don't think that capital will lead the way. Capital will follow, and it follows really fast. So, you know, I wouldn't lose so much sleep on that. And in fact, the state's been rather proactive on that front for the past 7 or 8 years, and I think they've seen some benefit from it.
It's a good preview. In fact, we'll have a conversation with Business Oregon on Wednesday about some of their activities and some of the things that they're changing. Representative Parrish, and
thank
I think
you.
We're going to probably wrap it up here.
With regard to capital, and you talk about, you know, where people cash out, I mean, you're in touch with a lot of these people. I mean, can you address whether or not they're actually cashing out in Oregon or whether they are realizing that gain in a more tax-friendly state? I talked to somebody in the banking industry who says that, you know, they're seeing the balances move from Oregon to Washington on their books, and those gains are being realized in Washington versus Oregon. So can you speak to that? You're kind of intimately connected to some of those folks.
I don't know the pervasiveness of that, but clearly from an anecdotal standpoint and personal experience of watching how this gets done, tax planning in that regard is an active practice. Like I said, I don't know the pervasiveness of the problem, so it would be an overreach for me to put a percentage on it. But it's legal, common, and effective, and people do it. You know, but I don't know the pervasiveness of it.
We have had that conversation, Representative Parrish, in the Revenue Committee, and I don't recall the numbers off the top of my head, but they do exist. I would point out that that has been the case for a long time with the very different tax structures in Oregon and Washington. It's a worthwhile discussion, and some of us are very interested in how that might change too, so I appreciate the point. Any other questions in here?
This is very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. I think that's just sort of our intro, and hopefully you can think about these things a little bit. The intro discussions will continue on Wednesday. We're going to hear from Business Oregon, better known as the Business Development Department, about their activities, some of the things that they've got planned. And then on Friday, we'll hear from ODOT, the Department of Transportation, and then next week we'll start hearing bills. So if there's not anything else for the good of the order, we'll close the informational meeting. And adjourn.